911, what are you reporting?
I got a strange going on out here. Something just killed my dog.
Something killed your dog?
My dog went flying through the air over the tree. I don't know how it did it.
Okay.
Damn it, I'm really confused. All I saw was my dog coming over the fence, and he was dead when she hit the ground. I didn't see any cars. All I saw was my dog coming over the fence.
What are you reporting?
We got someone or something crawling around out here.
Did you see what it was?
There was. It was standing up. I'm out here looking through the window now and I don't see anything. I don't want to go outside. Jesus Christ, you better...
Sheriff?
Dia!
Hello?
Get somebody out here.
What's going on now, sir?
That son of a bitch is about 6 foot nine, I don't know.
Do you see him now, sir?
Yes, I'm looking right at him.
Uh-oh.
Hey, everybody. This is Les Stroud. Yes, yes, I know. A.K.A. Survivor Man. And you're listening to Brian on Sasquatch Odyssey.
Hey guys, and welcome back to Sasquatch Odyssey. Thank you guys so much for clicking play. It is Thursday. We've got a great story time lined up for you, but as always, I want to start the show by inviting you. If you've had an encounter and you'd like to be on the show, shoot me an email. You get me at brian@sasquatchodyssey.net. Head over to the website, check out our Patreon page. You can become a member there and help support the show. As promised, it's Thursday and I'm back with your weekly story time, and I've got a couple of cool stories to tell you, and we'll get to those in a minute. But I'm also going to include a section of a book that I recently read, and I actually have this guy coming on the show. He'll be the guest on tomorrow's show, which will be Friday, so you'll have to come back and listen to Levi Makovic. He is the author of The Sasquatch Paradox. We had a really, really cool conversation a couple of weeks ago, and I'm putting that together, and it'll be out tomorrow, so you guys don't want to miss that show. But Levi gave me permission to read a little bit out of the book for you guys, and I think it's really interesting, and I think you're really going to enjoy what I have to bring from the book. The book is phenomenal. It's well put together. It's well written, and I think you're really going to enjoy the book, and I think you're really going to enjoy the conversation that I had with Levi. But I've got a little bit of that in here for story time. And it's sort of going to the lack of scientific involvement from the scientific community in Bigfoot research. We'll get to that in a minute. I don't want to spoil it. I'm going to let you guys listen to it. If you would, just take a couple of seconds, rate and review the show. Check out our Patreon page. Consider becoming a member. We're actually looking to go to Beachfoot. I'm really excited. We just got our invite for Beachfoot this year. And we're trying to put together the funds to head out to Beachfoot. So you guys heading over to Patreon and helping support the show really would help us. It's about 2,000 miles from here, so we're going to try to get there. We got the invite thanks to Todd Neese. I really appreciate that, Todd, and we're going to try to make that happen. So enough of that, enough housekeeping. I'm going to stop talking. I'm going to let the music play. You guys sit back, relax, and enjoy the show. The Sasquatch Paradox. Few people give enough respect to mechanics. Ensuring that their cars run smoothly is a necessity of life. Without our cars, we are unable to get where we need to go with ease. While there are many people who live in areas with public transportation, there are many who do not have this option available to them. Thus, cars must be kept in optimal conditions. The difference between a working and malfunctioning car in terms of effects on one's stress levels is highly significant. Mechanics are the doctors of cars. Granted, they may not have to undergo the same level of professional preparation, but they still help impact one of the often overlooked aspects of our lives. Mechanics are truly amazing. Recently, my mechanic was able to diagnose the problem with my car after only a handful of descriptions. He then recommended the proper solution to ensure that my car could continue to run in perfect condition. doctors share certain similarities to mechanics. Having a car breakdown is very troublesome and can negatively impact someone's life. However, there is something reassuring about the fact that your car can get new parts. If the new parts do not solve the issue, replacement cars are readily available. The human body is much more delicate than a car. If your body breaks down, the odds are against you being able to find a replacement. Doctors must be able to quickly ascertain what is wrong with their patients, so as to determine the best course of action for future treatment. The vast amount of time spent in training allows doctors to do this. In this manner, the diagnostic aspect is similar between doctors and mechanics. The similarities between the two professions do not end there. Both contain those who work under the guise of having a broad knowledge of a lot of issues, and both have those who specialize in certain areas of interest. When the clutch of my truck broke, it was a huge relief to be able to take it to the transmission expert, who fixed it quickly, for an extremely fair price. When my hip was out of alignment due to a four-wheeling accident, I was extremely fortunate to hire a physical therapist who was able to put it back into place with the simplest of exercises. We have so far discussed only the symptoms of the ailment currently affecting the scientific community. We would be remiss if we failed to talk about the cure. What good would our doctors or our mechanics be if they just told us the problem, but not the solution? The problem of artificial defiance in the scientific community is a major problem. Our transmission is leaving our car. However, the problem is serious, but the issue can be fixed with relative ease. When my hip was out of alignment, I feared that surgery would be the only answer, which could potentially have resulted in a debilitating lower back and hip problems that would impact me for the rest of my life. Needless to say, when the physical therapist fixed my hip with three simple exercises, I was majorly relieved. That said, sometimes a large problem only needs a small change to be fixed. The same is true for artificial defiance. It's a complicated problem with a simple solution. We only need there to be a scientific interest in the subject of Sasquatch, and the problem then should fix itself. My physical therapist told me that my back should heal as long as I continue to do the recommended exercises and avoid unnecessary strain on my lower back. The same theory applies here. Artificial defiance can be eradicated as long as the scientific community truly examines the issue with an open mind. It truly is as simple as that. You may be asking yourself, how can it be that this issue can be resolved so easily? Allow me to demonstrate how this has worked in other scientific fields. To the chagrin of many movie fans, I think that Jurassic Park is an overrated movie. While it was one of my favorite movies as a kid, and the adult in me can recognize its truly impressive scenes, the movie is filled with too many mistakes. None bigger than the fact that the velociraptors are so poorly depicted. They did not grow as large as they are shown to grow. Also, a Tyrannosaurus Rex would certainly not expend significant calories on chasing humans, when humans would provide it with minimal calories. Most of us, myself included, love dinosaurs. As I grew older, the accuracy of the facts presented in dinosaur movies became increasingly important to me. Indeed, that makes it very hard to watch any dinosaur movie, as Hollywood prefers drama over accuracy. That presents quite the dilemma. How do people who love dinosaurs but champion accuracy indulge in their need for dinosaur entertainment? This question perplexed me as I stumbled upon many books written on the subject at the bookstore. Seeing a dinosaur book on the shelf that day represented a must-buy. Needless to say, the book was filled with fascinating information. None more so than the fact that there was a lull in dinosaur discoveries in the 1970s. The first dinosaur bones were quite the find. Try to imagine how the discovery of one bone was enough to completely change how people thought of prehistory. Many of us would assume that it would automatically result in scientific interest in the subject, which is partly true, but it was not a continuous interest. Dinosaurs were a popular topic when the first bones were found in the late 19th century, and the interest associated with them continued for many decades. However, this was to die down. It went from being the topic that held the allure of the scientific community to one which was soon overlooked. So it should come as no surprise that important discoveries went ignored. The discovery of dinosaur bones by a local rancher in Argentina represented what was a significant event. though less for the scientific community than you would expect. You might think that this discovery would have encouraged paleontologists throughout Argentina. There was little funding and, believe it or not, little public interest. Little funding and little public interest were enough to stall the discoveries of dinosaur fossils. If these factors were enough to halt further discoveries in such a popular field, consider what effect little funding and public interest would have on a less popular topic. We assume that people were as interested in dinosaurs as we are today, yet that was not the case. Dinosaur fossils in the 1960s and 70s are analogous to the search for Sasquatches today. Although evidence was still being found, the discovery process was stalled due to the lack of interest from the scientific community and the public alike. However, once the public interest picked up, so did the scientific interest. Funding was set aside for expeditions after the 1970s, which led to more discoveries in the field of paleontology. We may believe dinosaurs to be fascinating, but we should remember that not everyone shares, or shared, the same interest. The power of both scientific and public interest can have an exponential effect on discovery. Look no further than that of the COVID-19 pandemic. We were sure that we were going to be locked down for all of 2020 and beyond, past the 15 days to flatten the curve. We were told by the former president of the United States that a vaccine would be available in 2020. But did anyone believe him? Part of the president's job is to reassure the American people. We believed his comment to be nothing more than false hope. Needless to say, that slight glimmer of hope has manifested into a general return of normality of a kind. Never has a vaccine been created so quickly. Universal interest and unlimited funding helped researchers develop a number of vaccines, which they did by the end of 2020. We are certainly fortunate in the variety of vaccines available. In case one vaccine may have been ineffective, there were multiple others that could be used instead. Do you think that we would have developed a vaccine so quickly if there had been no interest from the public or scientific community? Of course not. This is just the most modern-day example of interest helping further the discovery process. Looking back at Gareth Patterson's story on the Knysna elephants, we can see how powerful scientific interest in a subject truly is. The park workers were keen on the elephant's survival as it was an important aspect of their life. Using their knowledge gave Patterson an advantage as compared to going in blind. Talking to a forest worker, Patterson asked how elephants could have survived for so long without having been found. A veteran worker replied, "The forests are very big, and though elephants are huge, the forest makes them small by comparison." When there was a sighting of these elusive large animals, the excitement in the area was hard to contain. A photograph of a bull sparked excitement and generated increased public and scientific interest. Patterson had help when looking for these elephants. He had interested geneticists on hand who agreed to test the elephant DNA. With their help, the elephant's discovery inched ever closer to its conclusion. The DNA analysis of the fecal matter from the elephants gave Patterson much-needed information as to the number and the sex of the elephants in the area. Needless to say, the scientific interest helped solve this issue. We can infer that this same interest would have translated into increased conservation and protection efforts. The theory of evolution was accepted as valid after many years of fierce debate. Even after it was determined to be valid, there were still questions surrounding the theory. However, scientists took the time to discuss the theory amongst themselves. The theory was of interest and time was spent considering it from every possible angle, through every possible lens. We would not have the detailed knowledge of evolution without the interest from the scientific community. Thomas Kuhn argued that scientific attention was a key phase in the discovery process. He said, quote, "Discovery commences with the awareness of an anomaly, i.e. the recognition that nature has somehow violated the paradigm-induced expectations that govern normal science. It then continues with more or less extended exploration of the area of anomaly. And it closes only when the paradigm theory has been adjusted so that the anomalous has become the expected." End quote. Scientific interest is a stepping stone that must occur to make discovery possible. Without interest, you are left with books like this trying to uncover a phenomenon that could have been discovered long ago. The only thing that would have been and still is needed to prompt the discovery of Sasquatch is scientific interest.
Stay tuned for more Sasquatch Odyssey. We'll be right back after these messages.
Terror in the mountains of Port Chatham. Port Chatham, a bay on the southern tip of the Kenai, and former village of the same name, hardly seems like a setting for inexplicable terror and fright. But a series of mysterious disappearances and deaths where the Kenai Mountains narrow before plunging into the North Pacific gave birth to rumors that began in the 1930s and continue to this day. And the rumors all point to the same thing. Something's not right around Port Chatham. Take, for instance, Andrew Komlick, who had gone out logging in 1931. He was found dead in the woods from a blow to the head. A piece of log-moving equipment lay nearby and may have been used as the weapon. Around the same time, Elder Simeon Vasnikov of nearby Port Graham said that a gold miner headed out for the day and just disappeared. No sign of the prospector was ever found. Sometime later, Tom Larson went out to chop wood for fish traps when he saw something large and hairy on the beach. He ran back home for his rifle. When he returned to the water's edge, the thing just stood there and stared at him. Larson never could explain why he did not fire. Then in 1973, an Anchorage newspaper ran a piece on a retired school teacher that had taught in Port Chatham during World War II. She told of cannery workers who went out into the mountains to hunt Dall sheep and bear, but never returned. Search parties found no trace of them. Then rumors spread that a mutilated body, torn and dismembered in a fashion that didn't resemble wounds from a bear attack, had been swept down by the rains to the mountain into the lagoon. Other rumors included specifics of the beast's features. Hunters followed signs of moose across man-like footprints that exceeded 18 inches in length. As they closed on the moose, they realized that the owner of the big feet was tracking the same animal. The hunters soon came across matted down grass and indications of an apparent life and death struggle. Beyond the grass, the hunters found no moose tracks, but the large man-like footprints continued upward into the cloud-draped mountains. The history of human habitation around Port Chatham is relatively short, even though the crook of her sheltering bay offers protection from the turbulent ocean. Captain Nathaniel Portlock, a member of the British Royal Navy, found sanctuary here in 1786 during his Alaska expedition and praised the site. Around 1900, an American firm brought in a fleet of fishing boats and built a cannery to take advantage of the calm waters and the healthy run of salmon. The Russian Aleutic village of Port Chatham grew around the cannery, and by all accounts, it was quaint, tidy, and in a beautiful setting, nestled between the sea, the vistas, and the snow-covered peaks. By 1929, residents established a post office. In an interview that ran in the October 2009 edition of the Homer Tribune, Nanwalik elder Melania Helen Keel, who was born in Port Chatham in 1934, gave insight to the demise of her hometown. She explained that her parents, along with the rest of the village, grew weary of being terrorized by a creature the Aleutic called Nantinok, meaning half-man, half-beast. She said that many residents refused to venture into the surrounding forest and over time abandoned their homes, the village school, and moved up coast to Port Graham. Only the postmaster remained in Port Chatham, but the post office closed in early 1950. Earlier records made by the Portlock Cannery management showed that the site had been vacated once before. The cannery supervisor noted in 1909 that all the native workers evacuated the area because of something in the forest, but they returned to work to the cannery the following year. The stories did not stop with the abandonment of the village. A goat hunter in 1968 claimed that he had been chased by a creature while he was hunting in the area. In 1973, three hunters took shelter during a three-day storm and claimed that each night something walked around their tent on what sounded like 2 feet. In 1990, an Anchorage paramedic was called out to aid a 70-year-old native who had suffered a heart attack while incarcerated in the Eagle River Jail north of the city. While treating the man, the paramedic happened to mention that he had hunted in the area of Port Chatham. The elderly man suddenly sat up, grabbed the medic by the shirt, and asked, "Did it bother you? Did you see it?" The mystery continues. A woman sees Bigfoot melting into the trees. I lived on Coyote Creek Road in Wolf Creek, Oregon, and used to spend summer days at the popular isolated swimming hole about 12 miles out of dirt road that ran between Wolf Creek and the Rogue River. We called it the Jesus Save Swimming Hole after some graffiti sprayed on the rocks. In midsummer, I was there with a friend, and we were the only people in sight. I was washing my hair in the creek, and looking between my legs, I saw a head peeking over a fallen log about 60 feet up the hill behind me, and slightly to my left. Though I'd spent much time alone in the woods, this felt really creepy to me. My first reaction was to stand up and yell, thinking a peeping Tom was sneaking up to take a peek, as this was a skinny dipping hole, and my friend and I were following that fine tradition. As I stood up and turned quickly, the head sunk down and disappeared behind the log. Instantly, I had these simultaneous impressions. This large, round head with brownish hair. It moved like an animal, not like a human. The hair was standing up on the back of my neck, and I felt panic along with the need to flee. Within seconds, I told my friend something was stalking us and we needed to leave now. I looked back up at the log, and about 25 feet beyond that was a cluster of scrub oak. I could clearly see the head, shoulder, arm, and upper torso of a very tall creature standing upright and melting into the trees. This was not a bear. This was not a human. It was covered in brownish hair. Within about 90 seconds, my friend and I swam across the creek and climbed the rocks just below the trail. Feeling less frightened, I stopped and together we searched the hillside across the creek. But we saw absolutely nothing. They say-